Senate Judiciary Budget Division meeting will come to order. Today is Thursday, January 29th. The year is 2009, and we're in room 125 in the Capitol. I want to offer my sorrow for not being here in a timely fashion, but hopefully we'll survive that and move forward on this important matter. I don't know if there's anyone here that needs introduction, so we'll go forward and see where that takes us. I have on my agenda Judge Terry Stoneberger, Court of Appeal. Would you be kind enough to come forward? We've been collecting documents, and so I apologize for the late. Apparently, we didn't have the correct document to deal with the issue at hand. You should have that, and these are going to go forward. Tell us who you are.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Terry Stoneberger. I've been a judge on the Minnesota Court of Appeals for 8.5 years, and before that was a district court judge for 10 years in New Ulm. I'm here today on behalf of the Children's Justice Initiative Parent Legal Representation Workgroup, which was chaired by Justice Meyer, who's not able to be here today, so I'm a poor stand-in for Justice Meyer. I have with me Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom, who was on this workgroup representing the County Attorneys Association. And it's our goal here today, with your permission, to present the findings and recommendations of this work group. Thank you. And we thank you for your attention and giving us this time. The work group was convened, actually, by the Judicial Council, which asked the Children's Justice Initiative to put together a work group to look at and make recommendations about the representation of parents in child protection cases. So I'd like to give you first an overview of what we're going to do, and then we'll get into it. First, I'd like to just go briefly over some of the numbers that are involved in child protection cases in Minnesota, and then give you a brief overview of the processes of child protection in the court system, describe the important role of attorneys representing parents in child protection cases, and then Mr. Backstrom will summarize the existing statutes and rules about appointment of counsel for parents in child protection cases. Then we'll discuss the findings of the work group and the recommendations.
Do you have a list of who members?
Yes, if you look at your, I think you all have a copy of our report, and the members are listed on page 18 in the appendix. It's appendix A. If you look at that, you will see that this is a group that represents every aspect of child protection work, represented from the Senate and the House of Representatives as well, and the county attorneys, the county commissioners as well as county attorneys. So we had a group that collectively has thousands of hours of experience in child protection issues from every aspect that you could come at that issue. If you would look at your handout called 2007 Child Protection Statistics, this gives you just a snapshot of some numbers that come from 2007. At the top, you see that 18,348 reports of child abuse or neglect were made in 2007, and that represented 26,561 children who were alleged to be abused or neglected. The handout gives you some of the demographics of those children and lets you know that of those reports, 77% involved an accusation that the parents were responsible for the abuse or neglect. The little bullet called maltreatment determinations indicates that in 10,934 of those cases, the human services and social services agencies were able to handle those cases without involving the court at all. So they're doing a good job of triaging these cases and handling the ones that don't need court involvement and separating out the ones that do. But in 7,414 cases, there was a determination of maltreatment that required more severe intervention than the cases that could be handled through family assessments. Family assessments is a process of identifying family strengths and working on problems with families who are willing to work on their problems, essentially. So things go a little more smoothly in those cases and are resolved more quickly. The findings of the DHS and Department of Human Services, and also it's the consensus of judges that in almost all of these cases you will find some issues of alcohol, drug abuse, or mental illness. Not uniformly, not 100%, but there's a great majority of parents who are suffering from these problems, which is the underlying cause of the maltreatment or abuse. Under effects of maltreatment, you'll see that in 2007, 16 children in Minnesota died from maltreatment. 47 children were victims of life-threatening injuries, 168 suffered serious injuries, and 635 had moderate injuries. So these are children with injuries in Minnesota. Neglect is the most common type of maltreatment determined as opposed to physical abuse or sexual abuse. But keep in mind that neglect, although it may sound less serious, is research shows it sometimes has more serious effects on children. Actual physical abuse, as inappropriate as it is, lets a child know that someone cares about them, even though their behavior is inappropriate. Neglect tells a child that no one cares about them. So in some ways, neglect, although it doesn't sound as dramatic, is in fact a more serious problem for our children. 14,800 children spent some time in foster care in 2007. Now, some of those children might have entered foster care earlier. And the average number of days of children who left foster care in 2007, they had been in foster care 316 days. So that's average. And, of course, some of those children entered before 2007. In 2007, 812 children became wards of the state because the rights of their parents were terminated. That leaves them without a family. 672 children who were under state guardianship were adopted in 2007, but that's not the same 812 children because that would include children who became wards of the state in years prior to 2007 as well. Now, 100 children reached the age of 18 and therefore left state guardianship, never having found a permanent family. So these are children, we'll call them adults if they're 18, but these are people who have no home to go to on holidays, who have no one to call for a success in their life, and no one to turn to in times of crisis in terms of family. These are children who grow up without families.
Can you tell me where they might go?
You know, I have no idea. There's a lot of effort on the parts of the courts and social services to prepare them to enter adulthood and to live independently. There are some specific services given to them as they approach the age of 18 to help them know how to manage a checkbook, how to find a job, how to go on with school. I'm sure some do go on with school, and many of them find jobs. But as you know, historically, our child protection system has been about an 80% feeder of our prison system. So I'm not saying it's these children. I'm just telling you that we haven't had a wonderful success in making outcomes good for these children.
True of the general population that you're dealing with, that they either don't get coverage or if they get some, it isn't sufficient to be helpful to transition from an institution or in another form of security. Can you tell me what that would be?
For these children with no,
yes.
I can't. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I can't do that because our focus, of course, is on these children until they leave the child protection system and they leave at 18. So they are really without any group or legislation or anything that deals with them. They are simply adults and on their own.
Mr. Chair, if I might intervene, James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. You know, there certainly are programs available for adults in our counties who are needing employment, needing to be trained for employment. You know, we've got, jobs trainings programs. We have access, to resources that they can reach out to. And certainly before they transition out, they're going to be under the oversight of, child protection workers while they're in our child protection system. And as they're transitioning out of that system, there's going to be some effort to connect them with the type of services that they need. If they have continuing mental health issues or, you know, ongoing chemical dependency issues, they're going to try to locate a program that they're going to be able to continue to receive some services at. I just wanted you to be clear that there are some efforts to, you know, connect them with other programs even after they leave our child protection system. We just don't say, you know, abandon them completely and say, you know, good luck.
But one of the reasons we work so hard to make our child protection system better for children is to prevent this from happening. I mean, we want permanency for children before they become 18. We want them to have safe and healthy families, whether it's their own family or an adoptive family.
Senator Ingber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the report. My question would be, is that in 35 years of law enforcement, I've seen an awful lot of family issues and children abuse and whatnot. And question that I've always asked myself, and I'm in the position to ask those that are experts in this, should we be doing a better job of terminating parental rights? Should we be doing it earlier? In other words, should we be getting them out of these dangerous situations at maybe an earlier age? Is Minnesota doing a good job of that or not?
Thank you. I think this has been answered in part by some of the federal timelines, which have been tightened up in the last few years, so that right now when a child comes into the child protection system, if they're removed from the home, if the child's under 8 years old, there must be a permanency determination within 6 months. If they're over 8 years old, within 1 year. So we're beyond the stage now where in the old days a child could really languish in foster care without a permanent placement for years and years. And once the child comes into the child protection system, there are very strict timelines that apply to the hearings, to the review, and to the search for permanency. One of the unfortunate things is that once we terminate parental rights, we can't guarantee an adoptive placement. And that's another aspect of this, another, not the group we're working with, but other people trying to work to improve adoptive efforts and placements for these children, some of whom are teenagers already.
Thank you for the follow-up. So, I mean, we've all read the studies about, you know, the children reacting and taking on the repetitive, and we're going to turn them into the same thing that their parents are unless we get them out of the setting. And the age three seems to come up all the time. And you have to get to these kids before they're age three, four, right in that area. Can you tell me what number of that particular group is in this 812 adoptions where the parents' rights have been taken away? Of that 1,812, do you have an idea?
I don't for the adoptions. If you look back up toward the top, 42% of the children who were alleged to be abused or neglected were under the age of six. So actually slightly less than the majority alleged to be abused were under the age of six. So I imagine that statistic is, you know, give you some idea that these aren't all babies that are we're talking about here.
Thank you.
And Senator, if I could just add to that, unfortunately, you're absolutely right, Senator Ingridson. There's real challenges in our system to identify children that are being neglected or abused. And these statistics that Judge Stoneburner is going over with you reflect the cases where the identification has been made and the reports have been filed. Unfortunately, there's a lot of cases out there where we don't get the reports at the police department or at social services. Child protection workers don't receive those reports. And it's those cases we all worry about. And I guess we have to continue to do our best job. We've done, some real good work in recent years in terms of cross-training of both police and child protection workers to work together more cohesively and closely and to share information. As you know, there's laws that require mandated cross-reporting of these incidents, and we work together on these cases as a team in our counties. And I think that's resulted in a higher level of service and intervention and fewer cases once they get into our system that are not being appropriately handled. And we certainly move to terminate parental rights when that's necessary. Obviously, that's the last resort. You know, the goal is to reunify the family if it's possible in a safe way and that child is protected. But if we can't, we will not hesitate to move forward and file those actions. Now, one of the things, if I just quickly add, and then I'll turn it back over to Judge Stoneburner, one of the important things in this report is we're recommending why it's important that parents that are involved in these cases have legal representation. Well, we're talking about taking in some cases, taking their children away from them. There is no more serious thing you can do to a family than to intervene to separate a child from a parent. And when that happens, that is a critical stage where legal representation is needed, and it actually will, when adequate and capable, educated and culturally competent legal representation is provided, it's going to improve the process, both speed it up as well as result in a better opportunity for us to reunify that family if we can get those parents to start to cooperate. And it's oftentimes their attorneys, not the county attorney, but it's their attorney that's working with them to ensure that they're going to be in compliance with the court orders and the requirements and work with that family in the best way. So it really does improve outcomes, and that's what this whole report is all about.
If you just look at the last two lines, that the CHIPS means child in need of protection or services of the court. And there are 5,331 petitions alleging that, 5,331 children were alleged to be in need of protection or services of the court. Once those children are found to be CHIPS, then the court provides oversight and services that can be in the home or it can be out of the home. Of those children, 1,575 children had petitions filed in 2007 asking that the rights of their parents to them be terminated. And as Attorney Backstrom said, I mean, it's devastating to take a parent's rights away, but it also affects children when we take their family away from them as well. Even when a family is dysfunctional, if we can't replace it with something, it is a devastating thing. So, and of those 1,575 children, be aware that some of those would be children who entered the system, actually, maybe in 2005, 2006, earlier, been working with the family and finally gotten to the point where we're at the last resort. As long as the parents are cooperating, the children are safe, then we won't move to terminate parental rights. But that just gives you an idea of some of the numbers involved in Minnesota. If you turn to the color-coded chart, and I am not a big fan of charts, but here's a beautiful chart. And this just gives you an idea of the types and number of hearings and court actions that take place in these child protection cases. I think of the child protection court as a sort of a specialty court. You may be more familiar with drug courts and some of the specialty courts that have come along where there's a very hands-on approach to what's happening in the courtroom. It's not just your neutral judge making a decision, is this person guilty or not guilty? It's a judge and a county attorney and a guardian ad litem and other people in the process actively questioning what's happening, what's going on, is there progress being made, are these children safe, are the children doing well in their placement. So unlike a typical law case involves a determination of something that happened in the past, but a child protection case is all about what progress is being made right now and is enough progress being made fast enough that we can keep these families from being ripped apart by termination. So it's a very hands-on kind of thing. You'll see there's a lot of hearings involved, a lot of interaction. The peach-colored things at the top are things where people are actually in the courtroom participating. And the numbers across the top represent days. So within 72 hours of a child being removed from their home, 3 days, there has to be a hearing about the emergency placement of that child. Within 13 days of a child being removed, everybody has to be in court for the parents to admit or deny that the child is in need of protection or services. Within 53 days, there has to be the pretrial. And this moves along so that under the federal guidelines for children, this is a little deceptive, but for children under the age of 8, there has to be a permanency decision by 6 months. For children over the age of 8, a permanency action by the 365th day. So you see we start on day 365 with the termination of parental rights or sometimes there's a transfer of legal and physical custody to a relative or somebody who's suitable to take custody. In rare cases, there's long-term foster care because that is not felt to be a good outcome for any child. Or sometimes there's some foster care for a specified period of time. But the two most common dispositions are termination of parental rights or placement with another family for transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. Those would be the permanency issues. Of course, the other thing would be if it's possible to return these children to their parents, that's the preferred outcome, and that's what everybody's working toward in the system. Just a little bit about the role of a attorney in this case. I've mentioned how different these cases are from a traditional court case. attorneys we found are very, very helpful in these cases, because here we have a government agency represented by a government attorney coming in to a family and telling parents that they're not doing a good job and that they risk losing custody of their children and possibly rights to their children altogether. Now, most of us, when we're criticized for doing the smallest thing, become somewhat defensive. When your things closest to you, like your parenting style, is criticized, people become very defensive. And when the government's making the accusations, people are incredibly defensive. And they, you know, families will circle in to defend themselves against this outside action. We have guardian ad litem who represent the best interest of the children in these cases. We have no one who, other than attorneys, who can represent the parents in these cases. So the attorney's role is to, traditionally, as in all cases, to protect the parents' due process rights, to make sure that the government is put to their burden of proof in proving these cases, but also to a much larger degree than in any other case, the attorney has to be reassuring these parents to help these parents understand that, you know, what's at stake here is not something that you just want to keep battling against, but maybe something that you need to cooperate with. And maybe we can find ways to make the government offer you programs that are more appropriate to you. So it's not that we have to accept everything they offer point blank, but we need to find out what's going to work for you, because these parents have to change lifetime habits in 6 months or 1 year, change them enough to make a safe place for a child to live. So, you know, we don't expect anybody to be a perfect parent. I don't think any of us are, probably. And I've always said to people, I could probably find better parents for your children than you are or were. But, you know, if you're good enough and your house is clean enough and your child is safe and cared for, that's what people are looking for. So that's another important thing of having these attorneys be culturally sensitive, because we're not just applying a middle class, you know, white cultural standard to how you parent your children. But what is appropriate in this culture? What is safe? What is going to benefit the child? So it's just critically important that these parents have somebody there for them in these processes that are time-driven. I mean, you miss a hearing, you don't show up at your pretrial hearing for your termination of parental rights, and your rights can be terminated right there without a trial. So you need to be, you need an attorney who will work hands-on with parents, who understands the process, understands the law, and understands all of the cultural things that go into these cases, not just ethnic cultures, but the culture of mental health, culture of drug addiction, the culture of poverty, the kinds of things that lead people to be abusive and neglectful, and how to appreciate and use the programs that are being offered and somehow get over these barriers that make us so resistant to government intervention. I think everybody, I mean, that's part of our American system, is we don't want the government messing in our business if it doesn't have to be. And so we are all naturally somewhat suspicious of the government. But we need to find that balance of making the government do what it's supposed to do, but also helping these families take advantage of what's out there, so that best outcome everybody agrees is to keep children in their families.
Having said that, and looking at your chart and so forth, curious to know what your thoughts are as to how effective this system is, and what, in fact, would you ultimately, I assume in your findings, going to make some recommendations as to make it even more effective or less costly or whatever it happens to be. Could you comment on that?
I will, Senator, and I'll skip ahead a little bit to do that, because there hasn't been a lot of money spent on research of outcomes of some of the things that have been done. Our committee relied to some extent on its collective expertise in this field. We also relied on a study from Washington State and a study from New York City. In Washington State, there was an effort to give attorneys, these were public defenders who've been representing parents in CHIPS cases, but give them additional training, both in the law and in other cultural competency areas, to improve their interaction with their clients. And the study found that with these attorneys sort of being supercharged in this area, that the hearings went more smoothly, the parents were more cooperative, the outcomes were better, that is, they had more reunifications of families, and they had them in a more timely manner. The New York City study, and it's in one of your appendices, I think it's page 18, I can get to that later, but it was studying sort of cost effectiveness of having parents represented and determined that they were able in the long run to save money in the foster care area. So by spending money on representation of parents, they felt there was a savings down the road in the foster care area. So they're not big studies. They're not complete studies. I can't tell you 100% they would transfer to Minnesota, but the collective wisdom of the work group is that this would be an excellent place to start, is having parents adequately represented in these cases to make the case run more smoothly, to have the outcomes be better, and to be able to meet, one, the timelines more effectively, and to have mostly better outcomes. You know, judges are not investigators. Judges make decisions based on information brought to them. And one of the problems for these parents, who are often not high-functioning people due to either problems or just who they are and the way they've been parented, they don't know how to get evidence into the court. They don't know what evidence is relevant in the court. A judge can make a perfectly defensible decision based upon the evidence the judge has before him or her, a decision that would be upheld in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. It may be a terrible decision for the child involved just because the judge was not given the appropriate information. And you have read about some of those cases in the recent past. So it's imperative that we have high-functioning people in the courtroom who can make these cases run smoothly and get the information before the judge that the judge needs to make the best decision for these families. You know, we're not always going to be perfect in making these decisions anyway, but getting the information is critical. With that, I'd like to have Attorney Backstrom just give you an overview of the existing laws regarding parent representation in Minnesota.
I think.
I've heard a number of folks talk about what we have in the current system and what occurs in the courtroom. And just briefly, can you tell me how that plays out? Would it be better if there weren't this group of attorneys and so forth to have a more or less formal system, if you will, and an attempt to do things not omitting all of the folks that you're talking about in the area pretty much? And is that a viable way to go, or are these folks that say that we should do with a lot less lawyers in the ship proceedings?
Well, I think I and the work group would say they're wrong. But I'll tell you this. There are some innovative things going on, and I could speak from personal experience on the district bench. We've done some things called family group conferencing, where we bring in the parents, the child if the child is of appropriate age, foster parents, other interested parties, grandparents, aunts and uncles, school teachers, police officers, but police officers been involved in a case. People who are interested in this child and this child's welfare and the outcome of this system. And you can do it, you know, there's one where you pass a feather, and you can't speak unless you've got the feather in your hand to keep the order or a string or something. But they're informal, but they allow everyone to speak, and there's usually somebody, often the judge, controlling the meeting. Those are sometimes very helpful in getting good solutions out, getting information out that might not come into a formal courtroom setting, and getting people to think innovatively about how to best serve this family and this child. Olmsted County has I'm not sure what they call their process, but it's a similar process that happens early before the case goes into the court. But Olmsted County's found that it works best when the parents are represented by an attorney at those processes. Same with the family group conferencing. You know, when a judge asks a parent a question, sometimes they just freeze. Sometimes they don't hear what you're asking. It's worse maybe when you're wearing your black robe and sitting on the bench, but there is still that, I don't know, there's just like a wall between what you're doing. And so if the parent has their advocate there, either the advocate can speak for them or can assist the parent in answering the question, feeling more comfortable and speaking up to the judge and saying exactly what they think. So representation, you know, it's not just a matter of a formal court hearing, but representation in the whole process. Is important, I think, because these are not people who are used to putting themselves forward in a positive, persuasive manner. So having a voice, I mean, if you were in a situation where you were just felt very foreign and very attacked, having somebody with you who knows the system, knows the rules, knows the laws to help you through that, it just makes it much smoother for everybody involved.
Well, I know in some situations that's very likely to be the outcome if a judge is busy counseling a person who has to do procedures and so forth. They don't have time to come together parts of it, I would think.
That's true. Very true.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to your last question, I think it is important that this body keep in mind that this is an adversary process. And whenever we have an adversary process, I think, you know, it's a fundamental due process, right, that the parties to that process all have legal representation. I mean, we have long prided ourselves with our system of public defense for representing those who are charged with crimes, and again, we're talking about very fundamental and serious interventions into families in these cases. And I would submit to you that under those circumstances, parents of the children that are involved in these proceedings do need to have legal representation. These are some of the most difficult cases that we deal with in our process. They're not easy. They're tough. We're talking about the safety and protection of our children. There isn't much that's more important in our society than that. And I can tell you that these cases are of a high priority to Minnesota's county attorneys, our child protection agencies in our counties, as well as our police departments. And as you might suspect, a number of these cases involve a dual track. There's both a criminal prosecution going on to prosecute the offender who has abused or neglected the child. At the same time, we're intervening to protect the welfare and the best interests of that child in a separate civil proceeding. They're going on at the same time. And I say, that, you know, to offer a representation on one side and not on the other, I don't think that fits in the level of fairness and appropriateness. So with that being said, and I do just want to point out that, you know, the presence and participation of counsel for parents in both CHIPS and other permanency cases does lead to at least a better understanding by the parents of their responsibilities under the law. It protects their rights, as I've discussed. It promotes compliance by parents with recommendations of the case plan that's being developed by all of the parties involved as we try to work through these processes. It does accelerate permanency decisions, and it shortens the duration of out-of-home placements. And those are all positive things in terms of saving money and also, more importantly, protecting the children involved in these cases. So I do think representation does add a great deal to that. That being said, let me just quickly walk you through, and if you want to turn to page 19, there's an excellent discussion in Appendix B of the report of the current law in Minnesota that relates to these proceedings and the representation of parties in these proceedings. Minnesota Statutes 260C.163 discusses the appointment of counsel in cases such as this, and it clearly points out that both the children, parents, guardians, or custodians have a right to effective assistance of counsel in connection with these proceedings in juvenile court, and that the current law, however, the right is not absolute for parents. It's absolute for the children, but for parents or guardians, the right is contingent upon the determination by the judge as to whether the representation is appropriate or necessary. And I think one of the recommendations of our committee is that that become a mandate, that it's always appropriate and necessary that they be represented in these proceedings, and we just would encourage some clarification of that. The right of representation by the public defender is set forth in 611.14 under Minnesota statutes. Clearly, the public defender has the obligation to represent any child that's 10 years of age or older that's who's entitled to representation by counsel in these types of proceedings. That's a mandate under the law, and they have not given up the representation when they this past July indicated that they would no longer be able to represent parents given their current budget status, they still are continuing to represent the children in these proceedings. Then the quest, if you look at 611.16, which is also a statute that relates to the public defender's office, and this is one that does lead to some differences of opinion as to this particular matter, and there is some differences of opinion as to who is obligated to pay for the representation for parents. But 611.16 says that any public defenders are required to represent any other person entitled by law to representation by counsel, which has led some counties to interpret that to include parents in CHIPS cases, or at least they could still be appointed to represent parents in CHIPS cases under that particular statute. This is an area that does need to be clarified, and we would urge the legislature to clarify this particular issue, and that's one of the main recommendations of our report, that these attorneys are provided, that there'd be a funding source dedicated to that, and it be made clear under the law how that's going to occur and take place. I'm not going to read all these statutes to you, obviously, but another important one, I guess, that's led to some discussion with the counties, I guess, is the if you look at 260C.331 on the top of page 21, it says that there are certain expenses that are a charge upon the county, and that includes a reasonable compensation for attorneys appointed by the court to serve as counsel in certain situations, and some would argue that that's the lawful authority for counties to be obligated to pay this. And then you look at 375.1691, which says that unless a county has had an opportunity to review this and put it in their budget, they can't be court-ordered to pay it unless they've had time to deliberate on it. And then if you read that statute further, it says that if the county board refuses to approve payment, the order may be paid. It doesn't say shall. It says may be paid in the following year. And again, that is one of the issues that's up for discussion. And there are several counties that have challenged their requirement and obligation under the law to pay for these services. Most Minnesota counties are doing our best to cooperate and on an interim basis have stepped forward to fund these, including Dakota County that I represent. But we have not foregone our right to argue that this really should be a state obligation, as it has been in the past, and as we believe it was intended to be by this legislature when they made some changes in the law regarding the takeover of the court system. But those are just the issues that are out there in terms of the interpretation of the statutes in reference to these particular matters. There are also a number of rules of court that are set forth on page 22 and beyond that also address these issues in the process. But I just wanted to take a moment or two to go through that and see if you had any questions regarding the current statutory scheme before I turn this back over to Judge Stoneburner.
Well, I think we need clarification,
Mr. Chair and committee members, I do want to make it perfectly clear that the counties are strongly supportive of funding, that this be a statewide funding source, and we understand that adequate funding needs to be made available. If it's going to be done by the Public Defender's Office, and they've done a wonderful job doing this work in the past, but they can't do it without additional funding. I mean, that is clear. And they need that funding if they're going to continue to do that process, or if there's going to be another separate system created through some sort of legal aid office to provide this representation. Whatever it may be, adequate funding does need to be made available.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'll just bring in that in 2005, I had the honor of chairing a work group that was actually called for by the legislature, asked the auditor to convene a work group to study the use of public defenders in these cases, and we issued our final report in 2005 discussing the need for the public defenders to be funded if they were going to be able to continue to represent parents and doing some triage work if they weren't. And they've come to the point now where they just can't afford to represent any parents. So that's where we are at this point. The public defenders are not representing parents. The judges in the districts are scrambling to make these appointments. And then everyone is throwing up their hands about who's going to pay the bill for this. So right now we're in a somewhat of a crisis in the court system. About how this is going to all be resolved. But back to our work group, which was looking at the best of all possible worlds rather than the dirty details of our current situation, we started out with our findings. You'll find them begin on page 8 of the report. And the first one is not so much a finding as a restatement of the objectives of child protection court proceedings and Indian child welfare proceedings. And we just reiterate basically what's set forth in the federal and state laws, that the objectives of child protection court proceedings is to timely achieve child safety, permanency, and well-being. And the objective of the Indian child proceedings are to protect the best interests of the Indian child and to promote the stability and security of Indian tribes and families. I'm not an expert in Indian tribal law. I handled a few cases as a district court judge, but that is a whole nother very specialized area of child protection work that adds a whole nother layer of intricacies and complexities of protecting both the child's and the tribe's interests in these cases. Our finding number 2 is that representation of parents in child protection cases by qualified and culturally competent attorneys for parents improves outcomes for children and families. We say that with authority based on very little empirical data. We have the Washington case research done, we have the New York City research done, and we have our own thousands of hours of experience in child protection, anecdotal information. I know that there's two concepts in this finding. One is that parents need attorneys in these cases, but the second and equally important is that they need competent, qualified, culturally competent attorneys. Right now, I can tell you anecdotally, because I go to district judges' meetings throughout the state, that I have heard both judges and county's attorneys complaining that since the public defenders who were qualified, culturally competent, and were doing this work have stopped doing it, you know, the court is reduced to appointing who is available, who can I get to do this work. And good-hearted as the attorney might be, as well-qualified as they might be in their normal practice, they step into the morass of child protection laws and rules. And I tell you, they are the most complicated rules in our court system and some of the most complicated laws because of this intermeshing of federal and state laws. And they slow down the process because they don't know what they're doing either. So now the court is not just trying to tell the parents what's happening, but also trying to lead the attorney who's been appointed through this process. So the judges and the county attorneys are throwing up their hands. I think in some cases they would say it's better no attorney than an incompetent attorney. And by incompetent, I don't mean to just talk about the competencies of these attorneys in general, but incompetent in this area of child protection. So, you know, the funding source, and I know funding is the elephant in the room, but it's not just a matter of getting $50 an hour for a volunteer who's willing to go into court and stand with these people. It's enough funding to train these people so that they are competent to do this work and to pay at least an adequate sum that competent people will do this work. If you were going to have heart surgery, my guess is you wouldn't want the recent graduate from medical school who's never done it before. And I tell you that terminating families is as serious as heart surgery. It is heart surgery in some ways. So, you know, we need people who know how to do this if we're going to make it work. So, cases, representation of parents by qualified, culturally competent attorneys will improve the outcomes. And we know that from the Washington study, and we know that from seeing it happen in our own courts.
Can you tell me what the difference would be if you're weighing using psychiatric or social work or someone that's knowledgeable in that area versus a judge?
I think it's a problem. You know, both ways it's a problem, because the person who's very knowledgeable in the issues of mental health, addiction, child development, those kinds of things that are important, we usually get that expertise through the fact that we have assessments done of these parents by those kinds of people who have that competence and bring that evidence into court. If they were there with the parent, their problem is they have no clue about how to introduce evidence into court. They have no clue how to qualify a document as admissible into a court proceeding. And so, again, I mean, the judges can't just suspend the rules of evidence in these cases and say, oh, well, this is family law. We don't care how this evidence is or how competent it is or if it's, you know, it's got any basis or foundation or not. We'll just let it in. We can't operate that way. So we do have to stick with our fundamental rules of evidence and those kinds of things. So, it's
– really look at that, that there is a kind of a need for someone that is in a different situation as far as education. Tell me this, what, until recently we never had a guardian ad litem, now I have that. Is that an effective use of staff time or whatever cost? Kind of look at a situation, so you've got the gal and you've got the child getting the best for the child, and then you've got the prosecutor, then you've got the public defender, and probably each of the parents has somebody, so you've got a whole group of things in there that use a lot of staff time, and that's why I know they need some of these consultant bases, it seems to me, but it also, I'm still not convinced that we need a guardian ad litem and need all of the folks involved in this to be represented by counsel, except for the
right, and sometimes children only have a guardian ad litem and not an attorney. In some states, guardian ad litems are attorneys. In Minnesota, they are not. I would say not every case is the guardian ad litem need an attorney, but sometimes they do. The problem with these cases is that it doesn't involve just a dispute between two people. We have the interest of the child, the interest of the custodial parent. We sometimes have an interest of a non-custodial parent who may be become the adopt or the custodial parent if there's a transfer of custody. So there are a lot of different people involved in these cases, which is one reason they need different representation and different voices. We have social services who are represented by the county attorney. The guardian ad litem's role is to represent the best interests of the child. Sometimes the child will also have an attorney because the attorney's role is to speak on what the client wants. Now, and you can find, you can have a 16-year-old child who wants something, and the guardian ad litem doesn't think it's in that child's best interest, and the judge needs to sort out, if I'm talking about a 16-year-old child, will I be better off ordering what this child wants and is likely to buy into, or imposing something that the guardian ad litem thinks is in the child's best interest? Those are the kinds of decisions judges have to make, but they need a lot of information to make it. And if nobody is there to speak up for the child about what the child wants, and the judge only hears what the guardian ad litem thinks is in the child's best interest, you can be ordering a 16-year-old child to do something that all you create is oppositional defiant disorder, which if you've had a teenager, you know what it is. I know it sounds like a lot of people, and it sounds like a mess, and it sounds like it must be unruly in the courtroom, but from experience, I can tell you that having these people there makes it much better than not having these people there. If you think a judge has trouble getting information from a parent in a courtroom, a judge trying to get information from a 16-year-old child is like you asking how their day went, and they say, fine. Even if you take off your robe and you take them into chambers or you take them into a child-friendly room and try to talk, you don't get much more than you get at the dinner table on a bad day. So it is important that these people have representatives who have time to be with them outside the courtroom to gather the information and to be able to present it coherently to the judge. If the judges had unlimited time, maybe we could get this done without representatives. But the judges are on, our district court judges are on a treadmill. You know, they are working as fast as they can to keep up with their caseloads. They are spending an average of 6 minutes on a DWI criminal case. And I tell you, they're giving more time to these child protection cases, but the judges do not have the time to draw out the good information that's going to lead to good decisions. And we can make decisions. You know, we can, as I say, we can make decisions that are upheld by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, but that doesn't mean they're decisions that are going to keep those 80% of our child protection kids from ending up in prison down the road. So, it sounds like a lot of people, it sounds like a lot of money, it sounds like a waste of money, but I think the empirical experience of everybody who's been in the system would tell you that they're not wasted bodies in the courtroom. They have a role, their role's important, and if they're doing it well and competently, it is almost miraculous that your results will be very much improved.
Thank you. Members, do we have any questions or comments before we move on?
Okay.
You might want to just tell them the recommendation real quick.
Yeah, just to read through the rest of the findings that we think that the competent cultural appointment of counsel for parents would also be, in the long run, cost-effective. And I've used that 80% go to prison. I mean, at some point, we need to focus our funding on spending the money on the families and not on our prisons. And there might be an overlap for a while where it's more money. But in the long run, it should be more cost-effective to spend the money on the families and not foster parents and not prison. And that's what everybody's hoping for, is that we can save the children early, like you say, and not have all these expenses down the road from dysfunctional people. We also think that representation improves judicial decision making. I've talked about that enough. That was our finding 4. And our finding 5 is that this may also improve Minnesota's performance on national standards and protect federal funding. You may be aware there is Appendix E a summary of Minnesota's performance in the latest audit by the feds. And I'm sure it's labeled who does it. But they come in and see how well we're doing in meeting these federal timelines, and our federal funding is connected to how well we perform on those federal timelines. Minnesota is not doing well on many of these timelines. We're not doing much worse than any other state, but we're not meeting the timelines. We have 2 years to make improvements. Federal funding is at stake in those issues. So anything we can do to improve our compliance with those timelines is also money well spent. So our recommendations are amending the statutes, and our recommendations are on page 16, that Minnesota Statute 260C, 163, Subdivision B3 be amended to provide that parents have a right to representation and that indigent parents or guardians who are parties to a child protection matter have a right to public-funded attorneys. Not all parents are parties in these child protection matters. It'd be the parent from whose home the child was removed. So if you have a non-custodial parent, that parent is not automatically a party to these cases, would not automatically be entitled to a public-funded attorney, even if they were indigent. The court could make them a party in some cases, but so we're not talking about both parents or, you know, a whole bunch of people in this state. We're talking about the people from whom the parents from whom the child's custody was removed. But then when you get to the idea of terminating parental rights, if you're trying to terminate the parental rights of the non-custodial parent as well, then that person is a party, and that all parents who face termination of parental rights should have publicly funded attorneys if they qualify financially. And, you know, there's all these sliding scales. We can get people to pay partially for their attorney like we do for public defenders. It wouldn't have to be a zero sum. And that, of course, the Indian Child Protection Act has its own requirements that parents in both protection cases and termination cases have a right to publicly funded attorneys. And that is, I believe, mandatory in federal law, and I'm not sure that we are complying with that. But so, and then, of course, the appointed attorneys have to be qualified and culturally competent, and the work group believes they should also be involved at the earliest time possible. So those amendments would clear up the fact who's entitled to a court-appointed attorney and at what stage. And then, of course, we're recommending that the legislature should identify a separate statewide funding source for these attorneys dedicated either to a separate entity, some sort of a family defense fund or something, or if it's to the public defenders, that they get a separate division of the Board of Public Defense to handle these child protection cases because they are so different from the normal work of a public defender. And as I say, we know that funding is the elephant in the room, but we're hoping that at some point we can make the commitment to shift our focus to families and away from the expenses that inevitably result from our failure to give these children safe and permanent homes.
Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification, you were talking about parents' inability to afford, and then you talked about the case of the Indian, which is in the statute here. Are they under the same qualifications as far as obtaining funding as everybody else, or not?
For indigency,
right.
I'm sorry, Mr. For indigency, Senator, yes, I believe so. That we determine that right formula for deciding who's entitled to public representation and at what point do they need to pony up some money for that.
Mr. Chair and members, and it is important that our judges look closely at that issue of indigency. And I think at times, with all due respect, I think sometimes that gets glossed over. I think it does need to be looked at closely. And those who can't pay should be entitled to a state-paid attorney. But if you can pay,
right,
they should pay for their own counsel.
Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has anybody made an estimation of how much money this would take to adequately fund it?
I was just asking how much money it would cost to adequately do the recommendations from the task force.
Mr. Chair? Senator, I believe when Justice Meyer made this, and Jim, you can help me out, made this presentation into a House committee, they asked for a fiscal note, and that is being prepared.
And I also think you're going to hear from the public defenders.
Can they tell you what they would need in their department? They have that information.
Right? I'll wait.
Further questions? But, before you sign off, curious to know your thoughts on foster care. It seems to me that there's kind of a progression in the system where you start the offense isn't very bad and the problem isn't as much. And by the time you go through a number of different places to handle foster care, you've gotten, it's kind of like dealing with somebody with an alcohol problem. They kind of burned out and they're not amenable to treatment.
Are you asking about children who go through a series of foster care placements? Or?
That's my assumption. Though.
Right. I will tell you that the Children's Justice Initiative, which started in, I think, 2002, under the direction of Chief Justice Blatt, then Chief Justice Blatt, has done a good job, and, of course, there's always more work to be done, but and also because of the federal mandates and the DHS and our social services agencies all working together in this collaborative effort. One thing that happens is that when a child goes into foster care, is removed from a home, right away there's a great effort to identify right up front a potential adoptive family for these children. So even if this child may ultimately be reunited with its own family because of the services provided and the family's willingness to accept them, the hope is that if we put a child in foster care, that placement will be the only placement. And that family can become the adoptive family. You know, in the old days, foster parents weren't even allowed to adopt the children they cared for. That's gone away. And so looking for people right up front who might have an interest or for a relative who's interested in being both the foster parent, they can get qualified to be the foster parent, and a potential adoptive parent. So it's a big effort to not move children from foster placement to foster placement. And even if we're not looking at a permanency, a termination, an adoption, to have a foster family that's going to commit to this child throughout the process of the child protection case. I did have children before me who had been, I had a little girl who was 17. She'd been in 55 placements in her life. I don't think that happens now. There are circumstances where children do get moved once or twice in their foster care placement, but there's a huge effort to keep that from happening, just exactly for what you said, Senator, that the more these children are kicked around, the harder we make it for them to become functioning citizens. So.
Thank you,
and thank you so much for your
thank
time
you.
Today.
Mr. Kyer.
Thank you.
What's
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Let me first of all start off by thanking Judge Stonebrenner. I know she's been involved in this a long time. I think she chaired the 2005 committee that looked at this issue. I think she was a member of the 2003 committee that looked at this issue. If not, she was involved in it. I don't know if you were around in 1999 when that study was done, when we looked at this. But just a couple of points of clarification as we go along here. We agree with a number of these recommendations. But these are very serious cases. They're very important cases. As some of you know that have seen some of this go on in court, it is important that we have a proper number of attorneys, that they're qualified. The timelines and the CGI requirements that Judge Stonebrenner mentioned were and are important issues, and frankly were some of the driving forces that made these cases so difficult. And again, as we're going to talk next week about the budget, those aren't necessarily bad things, but they are things that impact the system. She also mentioned the kind of the dual role, and part of the problems or the issues of the dual role of serving not only as a counselor for folks, but also as their advocate or as their attorney. And that becomes a very complicated situation, especially when there are issues of admitting evidence or admitting behavior. So, you know, from our standpoint, we would like to see more of the programs that are, as they have in Olmsted County, and there's a couple others that are very effective, to try to get at these cases before they go into court. We kind of liken it to the criminal side of things. The criminal cases, the criminal justice system, and you have heard me talk about this and John Stewart talk about this before, has really become kind of the dumping ground, if you will, for some of the problems and the issues we can't deal with as a society. Mental health issues, chemical dependency issues, either because of lack of funding or lack of programming, you know, whatever it might be. I think the judge made the point, and I think our public defenders will tell you too, is that in these cases, there are almost always chemical dependency issues or mental health issues involved with these cases. And in the criminal side, too. They'll tell you 80% of the cases that they see are related to those issues. Just briefly on the statutory citations, I know that Mr. Backstrom cited Minnesota Statute 611-16. That is a 1965 statute that really was a holdover from the old county public defender-based system. Prior to state assumption, and I know Mr. Toom is going to come up and talk a little bit about that, is prior to state assumption, everybody was county paid and everybody was a public defender. It was a public defender for a criminal case. It was classified as a public defender for mental commitments. They were classified as public defenders for paternity cases. I think it was really kind of a language issue, if you will. So also under 611-16, if you read it, is very broad authority for the court to appoint for any case. And I know we've talked to a number of you in the past that it not only relates to these cases, but also relates to a whole host of other cases. Doesn't happen very often, but we get appointed on cases or attempt to get appointed on cases that are not even criminal cases. We had that use of the statute to appoint us to do a trust or a lawyer to do a trust. She came back to the office, she says, I can't even spell trust. What about setting one up? We had one where that statute was used to appoint us to somebody who clearly didn't qualify for a public defender. I'm not saying using it as an indictment of the bench, because they are very careful generally about appointing public defenders, but that's the kind of broad authority it has. Our perspective on this is it's up to you all to decide who gets a public defender and who doesn't, and frankly, you've articulated that in Minnesota Statute 611-14. You're the ones that have to pay the bill. You're the ones that have to see my face coming to you to tell you how many more people that we need, how many more resources we need. Quickly on the budget, and I know this is the budget committee, Senator Higgins asked about the issue of the budget. We put together a budget request in 2002, 2003, 2005, and 2007 to deal with these issues. Unfortunately, you know, times being what they are, we haven't been able to fund those. If you were to go down this path and have us do this work, to do the custodial parents, and again, I want to make that clear because there is the issue, as Judge Stonebrenner pointed out, of the non-custodial parents. To do the custodial parents and represent those folks based on our 2008 caseload, and to do the appeals in these cases, which is another area. I don't know if the study addressed the appeals issue or not, but that is another area that there are some issues, would be about $9.8 million a year. In addition to that, we have the non-custodial parents where we generally do not get appointed to. We do in some places we didn't when we were doing this work. That would be, if we assume that a non-custodial parent would be appointed in between 50 and 75% of the cases, and I don't know if that's accurate or not, I think it's fairly close, would be an additional $4.3 million a year. And then again, based on our caseload standards of how many cases a public defender ought to be handling in this area. I say that, and I caution you, just because it was on our 2008 numbers, the 2008 numbers were actually down. And also because the last time we went through this, back in 1995, when the state finally assumed the final pieces of public defender representation, those appointments in those cases went up 75%. And so somehow we have to have a check, if you will, about, you know, how are we going to use these resources, no matter who does it. If we end up doing it, if some other organization ends up doing it, somehow we got to have a little better scrutiny as to who's going to get represented. We have a number of cases where we have four or five lawyers on these cases, and as I've talked to you all before, is especially in the rural areas, that becomes to be really a difficult situation. So the board's position is this. We have done this work in the past. It has not been up to the standards I think everybody would like to see it, and I think that's evidenced by some of Judge Stonebrenner's comments on how we weren't meeting the federal standards, even when we were involved in this. Our position is, if it's properly funded, I think ours is the right place to do it. We have come to you in the past and said we are more than willing to set up separate divisions to do that. So that it isn't spilling over to the criminal side, and so that we do have, because they are very different cases in terms of dealing with these issues. So, that's really the board's position on it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kier, could you remind us what the governor's recommendation for your budget was?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, he is recommending a 5% reduction in the board's budget.
Which is how many million?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that's about $3.4 million a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of the governor's budget reduction for public defenders, it would be poor of us not to pay attention to the economic conditions outside. And during long-term deep recessions, can you tell me if we have an increase in criminal activity during those times and people are out of work and they come to less virtuous activities in order to pay bills? They may have reductions in pay. They may qualify to be needing public defenders even more so. Have you had any discussion about just the lay of the land with the administration? My observation has been as public defenders have not been recognized with enough funds in recent years to do their job. Now we have the full press of the economy on our citizens. I think that activity level is going to go up, and your department is going to get more demand with less money. And have you tried to point out to the administration? Do they acknowledge what's going on?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, we have had those discussions with the administration, with the legislative leadership. Chief Justice Magnuson, I think, put it best. He said these are, you know, the court does tend to be counter-cyclical, and obviously we tend to be counter-cyclical in terms of the economic conditions, both on the criminal side and on the civil side, frankly. But, yes, we're very concerned about that. We have ongoing discussions about that internally. Not only, even if you don't believe that poverty causes crime, there certainly will be more folks that will be eligible as we have more folks who are unemployed, underemployed, and as you said, start looking at some, you know, less than honorable ways to try to make ends meet. And so we have had that discussion with the governor's staff. We've had it with the finance department. We've had it with, as I said, the legislative leadership. The other issue, which we're going to talk a little bit more about next week, is we have some ongoing personnel costs, I think, just as you all have heard from some of the other agencies and the court also, that's going to add to that 5% problem. Not that we're assuming there are going to be increases in 2010 and 11, but just to pay for the ones that have been, you know, that we have to annualize that we have right now, plus our insurance costs and our pension costs for folks. So that $3.4 million is probably closer to 5.4 a year, maybe even a little higher than that. So we are going to be looking at, if this goes as it is, some very significant reductions in staffing for those items, those cases that we believe are statutorily or constitutionally required, let alone the ones that we don't believe are, you know, are non-mandated or are not mandated. So,
Mr. Chair, if I can pound a drum a little bit more.
Please do.
For a few years, I've brought up the possibility that of what other states have already faced is if they don't have an adequate funding in the judicial system on the whole, in a criminal case, it's a constitutional right of a defendant to seek a speedy trial. And if we don't have the funds necessary to provide a speedy trial to a defendant to exercise his constitutional right to that regard, the state has to open the jail door and let him out. And I don't think anyone wants that to happen in Minnesota on our watch. And so I've been bringing this discussion point up for years, and our judicial budgets keep shrinking. They aren't even keeping up with a rate of even cost of living increase or inflationary increase. They are definitely going in the opposite direction. We're going to hit a point where that will be what will happen. And I really don't want that to happen under our watch. And I think it's important for the legislature to hold firm on some of the appropriations that are going to the judiciary. And I don't want to give this speech on the Senate floor again, but I'm afraid we're going in that direction.
Well, I hope that you can continue to support the folks that are involved in our division here, because we have more than just a public defender and more in the district court. We get to clearly think about the legal and other things in order to work together into a comprehensive system.
Well, Mr. Chair, the things that we talk about with the judiciary financing is that those are the things that aren't the rights of our citizens written in statute. Those are the things that are written in constitutions. That's the core role, one of the core roles of governing. And if we're not adequately funding the core, then everything else kind of falls away. And so once again, we'll just have to rally and see what we can do.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Quick. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. And also I served on the work group with Justice Meyer put together for us this last one. I think the one, a series of four work groups. I also helped out on the 2005 one with when Justice Stonebrenner led that. And I'm here to give you the county perspective. That's what you asked me to do. But first of all, I want to indicate that we fully support the recommendations that were put forward to you in this report. And also want to point out that we really do appreciate Justice Meyer and also Judy Nord, who was a staff member who led this effort. I think they did a fabulous job bringing us to a consensus. We want to emphasize the statutes are in conflict. They are a little confusing. I wish I could blame Mr. Backus, but it wasn't a drafting problem. It was actually an evolution problem of the process, and kind of put it in perspective for you, some historical perspective. Starting in 1990, the state embarked on a takeover of the public defender system for indigent people. It started in one jurisdiction, and by 1995, the whole state, except for Hennepin County, who did not participate in the takeover, was under the State Board of Public Defense. And in that process of the takeover, I think a lot of statutes were left over. Mr. Kyer mentions these old statutes were left over, same thing with the statutes that would indicate that maybe the counties are responsible for paying this. These were old statutes left over from when we had a county court system. It was the counties that were responsible for representing all indigent people when the courts ordered. It was kind of a county court system. We still do represent some indigent people in civil matters. We do on civil commitments. We're representing those. We're not us counties representing. We're hiring and paying the attorneys to do those things. What happened during that 1990 to 1995 takeover was a dollar-for-dollar trade for those counties outside of Hennepin who chose to let the public defenders do the work. We lost, at that time, HACA, okay, and gave it back to the state because we were no longer going to take care of the state responsibility. What occurred, unfortunately, was that the – and it's really not unfortunate. I shouldn't say that. The Children's Justice Initiative started in 2001 with Justice Blatts and the Health and Human Services Commissioner working together to find ways to better represent families in these situations, to get more permanent placements in a fashion that allowed for these children to have a better chance in life. That's a good thing. One of the cultural changes that occurred, driven by the courts and human services, was to find better representation in the courthouses. And so this cultural change was happening. It's nothing that you were doing as legislative. It was just happening out there. In 2003, we recognized this was going to be more attorneys. And so the Chief Justice, bad timing, if you remember 2003, actually I was told by Mr. Kyer, Justice Blatts went to the governor's office to plead for this the very day he got the 2002 November forecast. So you can see we're kind of hit with a little bit of a bad timing, and unfortunately has been ignored for a while. Now, there was no question that this was a transfer of duties. Public defenders were doing this representation in our counties. There's a principle in law we call the part performance. They were performing. There was a contract there. We understood it, and everybody accepted it. They were doing this work. Unfortunately, they're not getting paid for it. The amount of attorneys that have been appointed under the new system have essentially doubled from what they took over in 1990 to 1995. That's a lot of a burden for them to take on. But then, of course, July of this year, the courts were put into surprise when they were told no longer will public defenders represent parents in child protection cases. And they were looked to the counties to do this. Okay, and I hope you see how we look at this as a little bit of a bait and switch, and all of a sudden now we're given an unfunded mandate. We gave up HACA back in the 1990s because we thought this was a state function, and now we're back at being requested to do this by the judges. If you look at Appendix C, page 25, you can find out what your counties are doing. And I will tell you, it varies widely what your particular county may be doing. Every county has looked at this slightly different. Here's the one consistent thing I can tell you, that everything they've done is on a temporary basis. They are looking for you to come up with a solution. If you look at any one of these decisions that were made by the county boards, they all have an ending date, and they're looking for something to happen. And five counties have chosen not to pay for representation under the principles laid out by Mr. Backstrom. Rice County, by the way, is the first one to do this, And can you guess who the judge was had to do the order to show cause for why the county commissioner shouldn't be held in contempt? It was Senator Neville. So he was the junior member of the bench. He did not hold our county commissioners in contempt, but he did order them to pay. And so that will be taken up on appeal soon. Maybe it probably won't be resolved before we're done, but we don't know. But Rice County is the first one to go up on appeal. Crow Wing County is also in the position of having a very similar matter go before them. 2 years ago, we worked on a compromise with the courts, with Mr. Kyer, with the Board of Public Defense. Senator Neville was the one who actually carried that compromise, and the compromise was that they would represent the parents, the custodial parents, and they would also represent the non-custodial parents, but we would reimburse them for that cost. I will say to you today, we are still very willing to participate in a solution. I would be happy to work with anybody who wants to carry a bill. I will be trying to put something together to get to a solution here, but we're willing to work on a shared responsibility model like we were willing to agree to for the last couple of years with the compromise that we have had before you. So we're willing to talk to you. We recognize the budget crisis that you're in and the struggle that you will have, and we're going to try to find solutions that are cost effective. But as Mr. Kyer said, this is a $14 million problem, and according to his books, that's a $14 million unfunded mandate that's just fallen on counties if they're ordered to pay by the courts. But in the meantime, you do have chaos in the court system. I think you talk to any of the judges, there's a lot of frustration out of how these cases are going to be handled, and the numbers that you see as far as handling this for our children are going to be worse in the near future. I wish I could say different, but that's just the reality as we try to work through and figure out what is the status of the law. So we really do ask you to take this seriously and help us find a solution, and we are here willing and ready to work with you for a sensible compromise.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tuma, Hennepin County seems to be the outlier in all of this. Will you talk a little bit about their cost sharing that they do, what percent of the public defender amount that is maybe Mr. Kyer instead? But how did that come about, and how would that work if we required every other county to do what Hennepin does? Rather than mass revolt by every county, except Hennepin.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, you know, Hennepin had a system where they were very integrally involved in the public defense, and they didn't want to give it up back in the state takeover period. And so, you know, fairness to them, they didn't give up the aid. They wanted to do this, and they kept doing it. Whether that's the appropriate model or not, if you want us to take it over, I guess we would say, yes, give us some more state aid. But right. I guess I have to check with my boss, Mr. Carlson. I don't think it was in the budget. I'm just guessing.
I don't think I saw it either.
You know, if we're going to go back to that model, you know, we'll run it. The counties are doing that right now, but it's not going to be the report that you just heard, where we have culturally competent, a well-run system, a statewide system. It will be, you're going to get a different sort of representation in Polk County as you're going to get in Hennepin County.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, to respond to the Hennepin County issue, and I don't know if we have enough time in the whole afternoon to go through all the discussions that went on back in 1990 and again in 1998. But the county agreed to continue to supplement the public defender's office, and there were a number of issues involved, and some of them you know about rent of the building and a number of these things. But they agreed to do that. In the mid-90s, there was also a lawsuit brought against the county and against the state by Mr. Bill Kennedy, who was at that time the chief public defender in the 4th Judicial District in Hennepin County. The county settled that lawsuit and said they would continue to participate in funding the office. Didn't say to what level, but it did say that they would continue to do that. As of today, the county provides about $8 million a year to that office. We provide right around $14 million. So it's about just about two-thirds, one-third. Included in that $8 million, if you will, depending on which way all of this goes, if you consider that if the counties are responsible for providing representation in child protection cases, roughly $3 to $3.5 million of that is could be, you know, accounted for as that CHIPS representation. Okay, so, but it is about a two-thirds, one-third split. And as you know, we've had some difficulty this last budget go-around with the county board in terms of them, you know, no longer wanting to fund that $8 million because it has increased for them. And frankly, I don't blame them. So that's another one of those budget issues, frankly, that we're all going to have to deal with probably sooner than later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, I many questions, but you know, I haven't seen these numbers before, but I actually did a little bit of child protection stuff on a very small contract in Hennepin County, so I have some sense of what happens from a practitioner's perspective, and the difficulty in trying to cover that, and that's in Hennepin, obviously, as opposed to. Smaller counties where the problems will be exacerbated you know, beyond where Hennepin is. And it's like anything else with this budget. I've been spending the last couple of days and nights working through the governor's budget. It's a difficult year.
Well, obviously it's more than just this issue. It's much broader, and I hope that at some point along
Chairman, I could be a touch facetious and suggest you know, join the club. I mean, that's the difficulty with this year is that I mean, these numbers are devastating numbers, and as I've said in some of the extrapolation that Mr. Mossman and I have tried to do, I would figure another $1.5 billion with the March 3rd forecast. I hope I'm wrong. But I bet I'm not too far off.
Well, and thank you for responding.